Pluto Press Audio presents Radical Intimacy by Sophie K. Rosa, read by Lily Lefko. Introduction. The intimate is political. People who talk about revolution and class struggle without referring explicitly to everyday life, without understanding what is subversive about love and what is positive in the refusal of constraints, such people have a corpse in their mouth. Raoul von Egum. Certain modes of relating can crack us open. We think this practice is ultimately connected to what will allow us to stop going to work, to take what we need. We are learning how to unleash our desires to the point that they rupture with capital. Clemence X. Clementine, Infinite Venom Association. Writing this book during the COVID-19 pandemic, its themes felt raw, sometimes too raw to touch. The meaning of intimacy shifted as social distancing became the norm. The relationship between closeness and care changed overnight. All at once, we were confronted with ourselves, with each other, and with the state of everything around us. As the scope of our days contracted, our emotional lives and relationships were magnified. To start with, there was much talk of the crisis being an opportunity to take stock, to decipher what really matters, and rebuild from there. As the government failed to take effective action to save lives and the death toll began to rise, anxiety, fear, and chaos took hold. It became clearer than ever that we need each other in order to be well, to survive. But in many cases, we lacked the language, modes, and infrastructure to express, much less meet, that need. Many people found themselves stranded. Intimacy is primal and inscrutable, vital and elusive. Like love, it is difficult to explain for good reason. Something so intricately personal, spiritual, might be debased by attempts at objective definition. Nevertheless, I will attempt to discern what intimacy might mean and to explain how I understand it for the purposes of this book. Upon learning intimacy was its subject, some people assumed this book would be about sex. Indeed, to be intimate is often used euphemistically in this way. Intimacy is much more and much less than sex, though perhaps sex itself could be a helpful lens through which to understand it. Whilst intimacy in general need not include any semblance of sex, as an experience, it might mirror some of the reasons people can find sex meaningful. Like sex, intimacy can allow us to access desire, pleasure, comfort, tending, tenderness, coming together, and feelings of being seen. But just as not all sex is intimate, not all intimacy is sexual. Intimacy encompasses many kinds of relationships. It is a way of being together that might include fleeting or enduring experiences of affinity, vulnerability, nearness, and love. The intimate realm has a broader valence too. It can refer to the textures of the personal and the everyday, the essence of our lives. Moreover, it can be, as the geographer Paul Jackson suggests, a form of commoning that is often arduous. It is, as he writes, overdetermined by desire, but can also be built upon common suffering. My use of intimate draws upon all these understandings to compose a rubric that includes connection, care, and community. Put another way, relationships, social reproduction, and kinship. In this book, I consider intimacy via different topics: self-care, romantic love and sex, family, home, death, and friendship. Initially, I imagined this book being called Intimate Comrades, as I wanted the title to capture the co-constitution of intimacy and struggles for a better world. My editor was not sold on comrades, however, if only because it might be off-putting for some prospective readers not, shall we say, on the left. He proposed radical intimacy instead, and I had initial reservations. I was concerned that people might interpret the term as prescriptive and assume my book would advocate for specific, radical forms of intimacy. It is certainly not my intention to do so. What, then, might radical intimacy mean? At first sight, the term could be interpreted as an extreme intimacy, deep intimacy as symbiosis. This is not really what radical intimacy refers to here, though it is not this either. Rather, radical is used to refer to political radicalism, a politics with imagination and abolitionism at its core, that seeks to transform the world by getting to the root of why things are the way they are under capitalism. For example, rather than campaigning for more police on the streets to protect women, a radical feminist politics demands police abolition, identifying the carceral state as a root of patriarchal violence. Or, as opposed to more lenient border enforcement to make life better for migrants, a radical demand would be border abolition, recognising that borders are not immutable and that their very existence is a root of racist violence. Abolition insists upon nothing less than liberation. As the prison abolitionist and scholar Ruth Wilson Gilmore has said, it is about presence, not absence. It is about building life-affirming institutions. In this way, radical intimacy aims to get to the root of intimacy as we know it. It explores the ways capitalism psychically and materially predetermines, infiltrates, and thwarts our intimate lives. It reflects upon why this matters and what resistance in this realm could mean. Radical intimacy considers, as the scholar and filmmaker Susan Stryker writes, how the state and its ideologies often regulate bodies in ways both great and small by enmeshing them within norms and expectations that determine what kinds of lives are deemed livable or useful, and by shutting down the space of possibility and imaginative transformation where people's lives begin to exceed and escape the state's use for them. Radical intimacy insists that to remake the world, we must pay attention to connection, care, and community as sites of struggle. Doing so could bring us closer to ourselves and to each other in ways that fuel our struggles towards revolutionary horizons. Capitalism is a socio-economic system in which life is organized such that profit is prioritized over everything else. This system rests upon the private ownership of the means of production by the bourgeoisie and the exploitation of labor power of the proletariat. The origins of capitalism are contested, but regardless of which account you turn to, the capitalist mode of production has been around for no more than a few hundred years, growing in Northwest Europe before spreading across the planet, including via colonialism. Capitalism has many stages and varieties, though today the word is often used as a catch-all for our profit-driven society and what it feels like to live in it. In this book, I use capitalism to refer to this socio-economic system, as well as the attendant forms of oppression it depends on, including racism and sexism. Sometimes I refer to specific oppressive systems. Other times I use capitalism as shorthand for the system that the scholar and activist Bell Hooks describes as imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy. The personal is political. A theoretical foundation for this book is that the personal is political. Popular in the 1970s second wave feminist movement, the slogan was coined in response to increasing criticism from leftist men that women's liberation, unlike class struggle, was not real or serious politics. Women's oppression under capitalism, including issues such as sexual violence, access to abortion, and the distribution of domestic and caring labour, was frequently dismissed by male-dominated radical movements as a personal problem, as opposed to the basis for feminist solidarity. The political work of consciousness-raising groups in which women gathered to discuss and find collective solutions for what the feminist scholar Helen Hester has called the material hegemonies of gendered life was belittled. The personal is political insists that the details of our lives can reveal structural power and oppression. As Michelle Barrett and Mary McIntosh argued in their 1982 work, The Antisocial Family, a key tenet of the personal is political is the idea of public discussion about personal life as an important component of radical politics. This book aims to contribute to ongoing discussions of that ilk. The 1970s feminist movement was part of a contemporaneous global mass revolt confronting the systemic oppressions of capitalism, including state violence and racism. Radical feminists and queers of this era often opposed the patriarchal nuclear family as the primary site of women's oppression and exploitation for the reproduction of the capitalist system. Many experimented with unconventional relationships and ways of organising care. The Third World Women's Alliance, a US political group formed in 1968 to centre women of colour's struggles in revolutionary feminism, described its position on the nuclear family thus. Whereas in a capitalist culture, the institution of the family has been used as an economic and psychological tool, not serving the needs of people, we declare that we will not relate to the private ownership of any person by another. We encourage and support the continued growth of communal households and the idea of the extended family. We encourage alternative forms to the patriarchal family and call for the sharing of all work, including housework and childcare, by men and women. By the 1980s, radical political movements faced widespread defeat. Feminism broadly settled on a reformist approach, an equality and rights-based platform that did not pose a significant threat to capitalism. Feminism in the UK today reflects this. The mainstream movement privileges white, bourgeois and corporate interests and has become associated with pro-carceral, trans-exclusionary and anti-sex work positions that are incompatible with feminism's central purposes of liberation from gender roles, gender depression and violence, and bodily and sexual autonomy for all. There is, however, a radical countercurrent in feminism in the UK and elsewhere today, which is reviving critiques of the nuclear family, social reproduction and sexual politics, and foregrounding anti-racism and abolitionism. My writing here owes much to this resurgent anti-capitalist feminism and is inspired by the foundational work of Black and Indigenous feminisms and queer and utopian revolutionary thinking. The case for radical intimacy. Foregrounding connection, care, and community in our political analyses and action can be powerful. Our intimate lives are the source of our heaviest sufferings and most relieving joys, and present ardent opportunities for transformation. Our intimate experiences, feelings, and longings give our lives meaning. They can give us reasons to stay alive. The reality, though, is that intimacy in the world as we know it is often lacking. As the cultural theorist Lauren Berlant has said, it's a heartbreak that the world isn't worth our attachment to it, that it gives us objects or ways of life or forms of life that are constantly betraying us. Our normative modes of relating and living often fall short, both in meeting our intimate needs and in allowing us to form and build the kinds of relationships that could support our struggles for a future of abundance, rather than recreate the privation of the status quo. The intimate realm is devalued on the left today, both in mainstream and radical ambits. This neglect not only overlooks the terrain's latent power for political movements, but sidelines many liberation struggles. For example, traditional labour organising mostly ignores social reproduction, such as care work, paid or unpaid, which is largely done by women, especially racialised and migrant women, often in private homes. Ignoring or diminishing the importance of the intimate realm too devalues the experiences of trans and queer people for whom normative intimate forms, such as heteronormative relationships and the nuclear family, are often exclusionary and oppressive. Revaluing intimacy then becomes a strategy to resist heteropatriarchy, which underpins capitalism, and therefore to strengthen our revolutionary movements. A political commitment to the intimate realm also counterposes capitalism's dictate that existence is about work and not much more. Indeed, whilst worker organising is at the core of anti-capitalism, a reduction of our politics to labour struggles and little else not only implies a resignation to life as work, but disregards the fact that many people cannot or do not labour for a wage. As the activist Steve Graby writes in relation to the Disabled People's Movement, a vital component in the struggle against capitalism is self-valorisation, or the autonomous construction of ethical values counter to those of a society based on authority and exploitation, in order to not merely react reflexively to specific attacks by capital, but to positively and creatively reinvent social relations. Paying attention to intimacy is crucial when building political movements. The intimate sphere is central to our emotional lives, and thus a potent site ripe for transformation. In this vein, considering the ways capitalism infuses our loving relationships, the sociologist and political economist Emma Dowling argues, as our material precarity increases, projecting precariousness in our love relations would be a good place to start to build effective resistance and with that, other possible worlds of love and care. Our intimate lives are the crux of reproducing, or not, life itself. Our relationships and kinship forms remake the world and, as such, are critical to our struggles for a better one. As feminist activists and scholars Camille Barbagallo and Silvia Federici put it, the struggle over reproduction is central to every other struggle and to the development of self-reproducing movements, that is, movements that do not separate political work from the activities necessary to the reproduction of our life. For no struggle is sustainable that ignores the needs, experiences, and practices that reproducing ourselves entails. Intimacy is essential as well as the terrain of pleasure and peak experience. Normative modes of intimacy often limit its potential, while our experiences and material conditions can make it hard to imagine, let alone desire, our lives being any other way. Imagining that things could be radically different can be a way to reject the exploitation, oppression, and violence in the world, helping us reimagine ourselves as capable of rebellion. This relates to what the writer and activist Adrian Marie Brown calls pleasure activism, the work we do to reclaim our whole, happy, and satisfiable selves from the impacts, delusions, and limitations of oppression and/or supremacy. According to Brown, pleasure activism insists that we all need and deserve pleasure, and that our social structures must reflect this, and that we must prioritize the pleasure of those most impacted by oppression. As the author Kay Gabriel writes in relation to trans liberation, the desire for a disalienated life world, as envisioned in the slogan Bread and Roses, is, if nothing else, the demand for everyone to enjoy the kinds of aesthetic contingency that capital cordons off for the wealthy. As a result, any genuine revolutionary politics will orient itself towards a radically pleasurable future. An overview of this book and some considerations. This book explores intimacy in the context of capitalism through a series of topics: self-care, romantic love and sex, the family, home, death, and friendship. These themes are intended as helpful lenses rather than purporting to cover every aspect or possible framing of the intimate realm. Each chapter looks at how a particular arena of intimacy exists in relation to capitalism, considers how this might be impacting, limiting, or harming us, then explores how things could be otherwise. Moreover, each chapter considers the ways in which the intimate realm can impede or facilitate political transformation, asking what it could mean to position intimacy as a site of struggle in our movements for a future with more connection, more care, and more community and/or communality. In every case, the book aims to be attentive to the fact that, in society as it stands, there is no way of doing intimacy that will, on its own, transform our lives, let alone the world. Or, as the feminist organiser Carol Hanisch put it in 1969, that all alternatives are bad under present conditions. To be manageable in scope, the book focuses on the context of the UK, though examples from other places are sometimes included. Considering the decisive ways that capitalism configures existence, it is an important framework through which to understand life. But it is not the only one. Our desires, emotions, and decisions have many origins. Whilst the economic system might helpfully be considered the umbrella under which all else is formed, it is also true that our lives are subject to other, sometimes more mysterious, forces. Psychoanalytic theory, for instance, considers the powerful sway that the unconscious mind has over our lives. For example, by compelling us to repeat certain behaviours stemming from past experiences. Waking up and remaking the world. Paraphrasing the philosopher John Holloway, David Graeber writes that capitalism only exists because every day we wake up and continue to produce it. If we woke up one morning and all collectively decided to produce something else, then we wouldn't have capitalism anymore. It is a tragedy that most of us, surely, would not choose to live in a world like this. We did not consent to the conditions of our lives, and yet we feel powerless to change them. The ultimate revolutionary question, then, writes Graeber, is what are the conditions that would have to exist to enable us to do this, to just wake up and imagine and produce something else? As we contend apocalyptic times, I hope this book contributes to the task of answering this question.